Before you buy a dental practice, one of the most expensive purchases you're ever going to make in your life, you need to make sure that you are buying the right practice. If you buy the wrong practice, you can do everything right, but you're still going to struggle. However, if you buy the right practice, you have a ton of room to make all sorts of mistakes and still end up very financially successful. I've evaluated over 500 dental practices, and I recently ran a report to see, out of the practices I've evaluated, how many of them have I recommended buying versus not buying? 85% of the practices that I looked at were not worth buying. Only 15% of the practices that I had looked at fell into that category of this is a practice that is worth buying. This is the right practice for you. My name is Chris. I'm a dentist and former practice owner, and now I help dentists buy dental practices. Today, I want to show you how to find the right practice to buy. I recently helped a dentist buy a practice from a seller who was doing about $800,000 per year in revenue. And recently I spoke with him, and in the last year, he's done about $1.6 million. So he's literally doubled the size of the practice. And the reason he was able to do that is not because he's doing anything special. This dentist is not even placing implants. He's not doing endo. He's not even doing that many extractions. He's mostly just doing standard general dentistry stuff, and he's doubled production because he bought the right practice. So over the last 500 dental practices that I've evaluated, I've come up with a list of the 10 most important things you should look at before you buy a practice. Point number one, understand the seller's plans post-closing. This is something you absolutely do not want to forget to talk to the seller about before you buy a practice. You need to ask the question, why is this dentist selling his or her dental practice? Oftentimes when buyers bring me practices to evaluate, I ask them this question, why is the seller selling his practice? And they say, well, I mean, I think it's obvious. He's retiring, right? I don't know. You have to ask. You have to figure that out. Just because a dentist is 60, 65, even 70 years old does not necessarily mean that they're retiring. I met a dentist who sold his practice in his 70s, and then he started a new practice and worked until he was 97 years old. You need to figure out why the dentist is selling the practice. I'm going to start off by listing some of the good reasons a seller might be selling, and then I want to talk about some of the bad reasons and some of the red flags that could come up once you start digging into this. So if the seller is retiring, and they're truly retiring, like they're old, they're done with dentistry, ideally they're planning on moving somewhere else, that's great. Maybe the dentist is selling because they have family matters that's requiring them to move to a different state or at least a different city pretty far away. Well, that's also a good reason to sell. Then the third reason is some sort of health issue or some sort of condition in which they're no longer able to practice dentistry. Obviously, it's not ideal, but it is good for you as a buyer if the seller has some sort of medical reason that they're not going to be able to work anymore. And then a fourth reason, which is similar to number three, but if the dentist died, if the dentist is dead and their family is selling the practice, well, then you don't have to worry about that dentist competing with you. Now let's talk about some of the bad reasons, some of the reasons that you need to be very careful about, some of the red flags. If the dentist owns multiple practices and they're selling just one or two of their practices and keeping the other ones, that's not a great sign. Because think about it, if you have two offices and one of them is successful and one of them is not successful, well, which one are you going to be selling? You're probably going to be selling the one that has not been successful. So if a dentist is still going to be working and you are buying the second practice that they don't like and they don't want to be at anymore, that might be a red flag because maybe they know something about the practice that you don't, a reason why it's not a good practice to have. Maybe it's in a poor location. Maybe the patient base is not very good. Maybe the practice just hasn't been profitable. I don't know the reason. I'm not saying you can't buy a second practice from a dentist. Sometimes you can find good deals, but you need to be very careful. Additionally, if the seller is going to continue working in the area, that can be a really big red flag because patients, which you are paying for, you're buying a practice so that you have these patients. If these patients end up going and seeing the seller somewhere at another office, then you are going to lose your patients. What's the point of buying a practice if all the patients go and see the seller at his other office? When you buy a practice, sure, you're getting some chairs, you're getting some supplies. If you buy the building, maybe you're getting a building, but maybe you're just leasing the building. But what you're really getting, what really matters is you're getting access to patients. And if the patients are going to leave and go see the seller somewhere else, then that's probably not a practice that you want to buy. If the seller is young and doesn't have plans to move somewhere far away, then that is a big red flag. Because what if the seller stays around, even if they don't immediately think they're going to be practicing dentistry and competing and taking patients? What if they go across the street and either work for someone else or buy another office or start another office and take your patients, maybe your staff, away from you? The thing you just bought, even though you paid them a bunch of money for it, they go across the street and all the patients just go across the street to see them over there. That is your big risk if you buy a practice from someone who is not retiring and who is not moving. Lastly, if the dentist is selling because of some sort of legal trouble or some sort of issue with their license or with the government, that can also be a big issue. Because if the dentist is being sued for malpractice and was doing some sort of behavior that was not appropriate, there's a chance that a lot of the patients have found out about that and potentially they have left the office. That can be bad, and it can result in the number of patients dramatically lowering. When you buy a practice, your goal is to make sure that that transition is as smooth as possible and as many patients stay as possible. And if there's some sort of thing going on with the seller that is going to result with patients not staying at the office, then that's probably not an office you want to buy. The next thing to look at is the asking price for the practice. How much is the seller expecting to sell the practice for? Oftentimes, dental practices will sell through practice brokers. They're somewhat similar to realtors, where they are going to help the dentist value their practice and then determine how much they're going to sell it for, you know, all the details, when they're going to be able to sell it. They help them through the process. They find buyers to buy the practice. They show the buyers the practice. They help facilitate the transition. These brokers will oftentimes set the purchase price for the practice. When you reach out to a broker, they're likely going to send you a packet of documents and they're going to have a valuation in there somewhere. Now, these valuations are really just completely made up numbers that are completely different with every different practice broker. They're different in different areas. How do you know if that purchase price is a fair purchase price? How do you know if you're overpaying? How do you know if it's a good deal? Obviously, I wish I could just give you an answer. I could say, well, if a dental practice had a production of this number, this is how much it's worth. But I mean, it's not that simple. There's so many factors that go into this. Things such as location. A practice in New York City is going to sell for a different amount than a practice in North Dakota. Practices tend to sell more in areas where more dentists want to live. So the big cities like New York City, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Denver, Colorado, Miami, those types of places are a lot more competitive because a lot more dentists want to live there, and so the value of practices goes up. If instead you find a practice in a more rural area, or maybe a suburban or smaller city, you can oftentimes get much lower valuations for a practice of the same size as a practice that was in a larger city. Also, the condition of the building, the age of the equipment, the overall number of operatories in the practice, the health of the staff, the visibility of the practice from the road, whether it's in an office building way back in some industrial complex versus being at an intersection on a busy street, how long the dentist has been at the office also makes a big difference. If the dentist has only been there for 1 or 2 years, the practice is not worth as much as a practice where the dentist has been there 30 or 40 years. As a broad rule of thumb, if you're going to buy a large practice, I want to see your loan repayment amount, monthly loan repayment, under 12% of your projected revenue. If it's a medium-sized practice, I want to see that under 10%. And if it's a smaller practice, I want to see that number under 8% of your projected revenue. I have found this is the best way to determine if a practice is affordable. The only thing that really matters when you buy a dental practice is how much money are you going to be making there? A lot of dentists get caught up into, well, is this a fair price? Am I overpaying? Oh, is this a good deal? Am I underpaying? It doesn't matter if you're quote unquote getting a good or a bad deal. What matters is, are you going to be making money at this practice? If your practice loan payment is too large to where you're not able to afford your lifestyle while working there, then it is too expensive for you. On the other hand, I have helped dentists buy practices which initially looked, oh, too expensive. Oh, I'm overpaying for this practice. But the reality is, some of these dentists go on to make $600,000-$800,000 a year after buying these practices and after taking into account the loan. If you're buying a business and making $700,000, the amount that you paid for that business was not too much. The practice loan repayment is just one more expense that you have to calculate. That's all it is. It's just an expense that you have to take into account. And when you run your projections to determine if you're going to be profitable at this practice, As long as we're keeping the practice loan repayment number in mind, as long as you're profitable, then who cares if you're over or underpaying? What matters is how successful are you going to be at this business? The next thing that you always have to calculate when you are evaluating a practice is the number of active recall patients. This is by far the most important number for you to figure out when you are buying a practice. Now, the brokers and the sellers, they're going to give you all sorts of numbers to try to tell you how many patients there are at the practice. There are so many different ways to calculate this number. I've seen some brokers literally say, well, this practice has 8,000 patients. And you look at how they got to that number. They got to that number because that practice, in the entire time it's been open in the last 30 years, has seen 8,000 patients. I don't care if the practice saw some patient 20 years ago. I care how many patients are actively and currently on the recall schedule. I also don't care about how many new patients there were last year. I mean, I care for other reasons, but when I'm looking at active recall patients, I don't care about new patients. If a new patient came last year, came for an exam and got a treatment plan, but didn't stay to have the work done and didn't get added to that recall list, well, then to me, that's a dead patient. I don't care about them. I mean, sure, if I'm going to buy an office, I'm going to have my front desk call those patients with treatment plans that haven't been completed and see if they want to come in. You might find a few, but that's just really extra. That's icing on the cake. What actually matters and what is the most important thing for you as a buyer is how many patients are already planning on coming back. They are on the schedule to see a hygienist. They're on the schedule to come in and get their x-rays, get their exams, get their cleaning so that you have patients that you're going to be able to see. You're going to be able to comprehensively treatment plan and find treatment so that you can fill your schedule and produce and actually make money at this practice. In order to be profitable as a solo dentist, you need at minimum 1,000 recall patients and ideally closer to 2,000. Once you start to get above that 2,000 number, that's when I would recommend you start looking into a group practice, maybe bringing in an associate, maybe part-time at first, maybe full-time. You need at least 1,000 active patients. I have some dentists that bring me practices where there's only 500 active patients. I'm like, that's fine. I mean, it's a start. It's like half a startup, half an acquisition. It's probably better than just doing a startup, but why don't you just find a practice that has 1,000 active patients to begin with, and then you're going to be profitable from day one. You don't have to take 2 or 3 years to grow the practice. You come in and the practice is already a decent size and you can start making real money right away. Do not trust the practice broker to calculate this number. The numbers they give you are not necessarily going to be helpful. You need to calculate this number yourself and you need to do it multiple different ways. The first and initial most easy way is just ask how many hygienists there are. Most hygienists are able to see about 800 active patients per year if they're full-time. So if you find a practice that has one full-time hygienist, it's probably going to be slightly smaller than where you need it to be in order to be profitable. The sweet spot for a solo single dentist tends to be 2 full-time hygienists. And it's all right if there's 3 or 4 hygienists that are part-time and overall the full-time equivalent is about 2. That's fine. If you have a full-time equivalent of 1.5 hygienists, that's more reasonable. That's going to be a smaller starting type practice. Let's say one sees 800, one sees 400. That puts you at 1,200, which is on the lower end of the scale, but it's within the 1,000 to 2,000 active number. But if you have 2 hygienists and they're each seeing 800 patients, that puts you at about 1,600, which is right there in that sweet spot of how many patients you need in order to run a profitable solo practice. Now, the key is if you're evaluating a practice based upon the number of hygienists, you need to actually look at the schedule to actually see if those hygiene schedules are filled and how many patients they're seeing. Some practices will have a hygienist see patients every hour. Some will do it every 45 minutes. Some will do it every 30. Some will do it every hour and a half. So you need to figure out how the office is being run. And when you first get the documents from a practice, usually they are not going to send you the entire last year's schedule. That would be too difficult. And also they don't want to share patient names during the initial documents they send out. So the next best way to initially get an idea of how many active recall patients there are at a practice is looking at the production by procedure report. Now you have to be careful. You can't just look at one single number to know how many active patients there are because every dentist runs their office a little bit different. Some will do a periodic exam every single time there's a prophy. Some will only do their periodic exams every other year. I've seen some practices especially those that don't have a hygienist or maybe don't have enough hygienists, where they're doing a lot of periodic exams without doing cleanings. Likely a patient wanted to come in and get something checked out, but they didn't have room on the hygiene schedule, so they just did a periodic exam rather than a limited exam. There's so many different ways offices are run. I'm not saying one way is right or one way is wrong. I mean, there are ways that I would consider right, but I mean, you can buy a practice where they're doing it wrong and you can change how things are being run. You can fix it up. But when you're initially looking at documents to determine if a practice is worth buying, evaluating how many active patients there are, you just have to figure out how the seller is running the office and then use those numbers to try to evaluate what the practice looks like. Generally, for the purpose of my estimates, one of the things that I usually start with is I add up the number of prophys, the number of child prophys, and the number of perio maintenance appointments, because those are the three main types of recall cleaning visits that you're going to have. And then I usually take that total number of hygiene visits and divide it by roughly 1.5. My logic for that is every patient is not going to come back at exactly 6 months. If it was at exactly 6 months, you would divide that number by 2, meaning if there were 1,000 hygiene visits and everyone came twice a year, that means the practice has 500 patients. On the other hand, if every single patient is only coming once per year, well, then the total number of cleanings would equal the total number of patients. Obviously, perio maintenance appointments adds a little bit of complication because sometimes those are every 3 months. But for the initial estimate, I generally assume the average patient's going to come back about every 9 months. So we're dividing by 1.5. And that gets us a pretty decent estimate of how many active patients there are. Another thing to look at is the number of periodic exams, because that also can be a pretty decent indicator. But I would look at both and compare and decide, are the numbers fairly similar? If those numbers are fairly similar, then that's good. If the number of cleanings and the number of periodic exams is way off, well, then maybe the dentist is running their practice, you know, in a way that maybe they're doing exams every other appointment, that kind of thing. So you got to look holistically at all the numbers to get a good estimate based on the production by procedure report. But that's definitely the best way to initially get an estimate of how many patients there are at a practice. Finally, another way that I like to calculate this number, actually logging into the schedule in the practice and go a month back and just count how many recall patients were there for an entire month. And then you can multiply that out to get an estimate of how many patients there were. And you can also go forward a month or two and you can see, are all those patients, have they been rescheduled into the future? And this is something you have to do later on in the process. Sometimes it's after the LOI is signed. I mean, if you can do it on your initial visit at the practice, that's great, but oftentimes you have to wait until the due diligence period after the letter of intent. It's also smart while you're in there. Go through and see, are the hygiene schedules filled? Just because they have a full-time hygienist on staff doesn't mean that that hygienist schedule is completely full. Ideally, you want to find a practice where there are so many patients trying to make appointments that the hygiene schedules are booked out for months. They just can't find a place to fit new patients in. That's the type of practice you come in, you add another hygienist, and all of a sudden the patients who have been trying to get in now are able to get in, and you've just increased the size of that practice. This is why it is so important that you properly evaluate a practice before buying. If you buy a practice where there are too many patients and they cannot get on the schedule, that's a huge growth opportunity. But on the other hand, if you buy a practice where the schedules are empty, you are going to inherit a practice where you have to pay a hygienist to sit around and not see patients. That's not fun. That's not something you're going to want to do. You might have to consider even letting staff go after you buy the practice. That is not something I want to wish upon anyone. Just make sure you buy the right practice up front, and it's going to make your life so much easier. Once you have that number of active patients calculated, and you know the production in the previous year of the practice, you can then calculate production per patient. This is one of the most useful numbers to calculate in order to determine if a practice is going to have growth potential or if the practice is already being maxed out or potentially past maxed out. The typical dentist is going to be able to produce somewhere between $800 and $1,200 per patient per year. If you calculate out this number and the seller's revenue is $2,000 per active patient, well, then that is going to be extremely difficult for you to replicate. And chances are when you take over the office, the production is going to go down. Your expenses are not necessarily going to go down proportionally to the reduction in production. And so what happens is you're going to have to take a hit to your net income. Let's say you buy a practice where production was $1 million and expenses are $500,000. The net income for the seller was $500,000 per year. But if when you take over, production drops to $650,000 and expenses stay at $500,000, well, now you're only going to make $150,000 in net income that year. Even a minor 20 to 30% drop in revenue could potentially drop your net income by 50, 60, 70, 80%. Your goal is to find a practice where the production per patient is as low as possible. I have seen some practices and I've helped some buyers buy practices where that number is as low as $300 per patient. I want you to think about this. If a dentist is only producing $300 per active patient, how much do you get for a cleaning and an exam and x-rays? At least $150 usually. And so if they come back twice a year, that's the $300 right there. If you find a practice where revenue is only $300 per patient per year, there is so much room for growth. If you can get it up closer to that $1,000 average number, you could potentially triple the size of the practice without bringing any new patients in. Now, it's hard to find a practice where the number is $300, but I've seen a lot of practices where the number is $500 to $600. Now, even just that, if you can go from $500 or $600 per year to $1,000 per year, that's doubling the size of the practice without spending any money on marketing, without bringing any additional new patients in, just treatment planning comprehensively on the patients that are already there. Oftentimes, these practices are being run by dentists who are older. They're tired. They just don't want to bend over and do more dentistry. They've checked out. Someone might come in and clearly they're a good candidate for three or four crowns, maybe veneers, maybe implants, maybe Invisalign. But the dentist is tired. He's made enough money. He doesn't feel like doing those things. And so he says, I will put a watch on that and maybe we'll do something next year. You come into one of these practices where watch. You turn that into treatment, and you are going to be rolling in with the dough. You're going to be making so much money. You're not even going to know what to do with all the cash that's coming in from doing three crowns here, five crowns here, veneers there, three implants there, new denture being replaced here, extractions and implants here. If you can find a practice like this where you can add value, you can potentially keep expenses relatively low and double your revenue. Revenue might go up from 600 to 1.2 million, but your profit might go up from 200,000 to 600,000 or 700,000. This is why calculating out production per patient is one of the most important numbers that you can calculate. The next thing to look at, and this is related to production per patient, is looking at the seller's treatment plan style. Is the seller under treatment planning, over treatment planning, or treatment planning an appropriate amount? The most common thing that I've seen is dentists who are overproducing on crowns. It's pretty easy to do, especially patients with insurance and patients that, you know, don't really care. Someone comes in, they have a little bit of decay, and rather than doing an MOD, you just say, well, let's do a crown. Sometimes there'll be teeth that are just a little bit stained and they really don't need anything done, and dentists will do crowns. Sometimes you'll have existing crowns that there's a little bit of staining near the margins, and then it says, oh, it looks like this crown needs replaced, especially replacing old crowns. Maybe you have PFMs and the dentist tells the patients, oh, you've got that metal crown in your mouth. We can replace that with a nice tooth-colored crown. Are they actually harming the patient by doing that? I don't know. Maybe not. It's going to depend on the situation. But it's not really your job to determine if the seller was treatment planning ethically. What is your job is to determine, is this a type of treatment planning that I'm going to be able to replicate when I take over the office? If the seller is doing things that you likely are not going to want to do, chances are you're going to have a hard time maintaining the level of production that the seller had. A big part of my evaluation process is I look at the number of fillings, the number of crowns, the number of root canals, the ratio of crowns to fillings, the ratio of crowns to active patients, fillings to active patients. Looking at all of these numbers to determine, is the dentist treatment planning within industry averages? If it's below, that's great, because you're going to come in and there's going to be a lot of patients that have decay, that have cracks, that have restorations that need to be replaced. You're going to have so much opportunity to produce. But if you buy a practice where the dentist has been overproducing for years, you might buy a practice where the first patient you see has six or seven brand new zirconia crowns, brand new veneers. They just had Invisalign done. They just had implants placed in all their edentulous spaces. You come in and there's nothing left for you to do. Make sure you understand the seller's treatment planning style before buying the practice. Related to that, the next thing I like to look at is specialty work. Is the seller doing specialty work? How many specialty type procedures are they doing? Are they placing implants? If so, how many? Sometimes you'll have sellers, they say, oh, I place all these implants. You look at their production by procedure and they did 4 implants last year. That's fine. If they did 4 implants, it's nothing to worry about. But if you buy a practice where the seller had placed 75 implants last year, you need to make sure that you're going to be able to replicate that. Because if you're not the type of dentist who's able to place 75 implants, then this might not be the type of practice for you to buy. Endo. Some practices are doing a lot of endo, and you come in and do you want to be doing molar endos every afternoon? Probably not. If you're a general dentist, you probably don't want to do molar endo all the time. If you come into an office where the seller was doing a lot of endo and you decide you're going to refer that to specialists, well, then your production is going to go down because you're not doing that. But the other issue is if a dentist is doing a lot of molar endo, is it because they just really like doing endo, or is it because their schedule is not very busy and so they're doing endo in order to fill their schedule? The most successful practices oftentimes don't have to do that much endo because they're so busy with crowns and other things that they just refer the endo out to a specialist. The specialist is probably going to do a better job. They're going to do it quicker. It's going to be easier on the patient. And then the patient just comes in and you just quickly do the crown. Rather than spending 2.5 hours doing endo, you spend 20 minutes doing a crown. You're making more money than you'd be making if you were doing the endo, because in the time that you would have done that one endo, you can do 7 or 8 crowns, which is much more profitable for you. It's honestly easier on the patient because the endodontist is probably going to be faster and do a better job than a general dentist is going to do. So I'd be careful buying a practice where they're doing a lot of endo. And then the other big one is ortho. Ortho's tricky, especially once you start getting into Invisalign. Do I think general dentists should do Invisalign? Sure, especially the easy cases, straightening out some lower anterior, some of the easy stuff. You scan them with an iTero. It gives them a digital representation of what it's going to look like. You have the Invisalign, pretty easy, pretty small amount of work for you for a pretty decent profit. I think it can be great. But if you're buying a practice from a seller that was doing a lot of Invisalign or a lot of ortho, especially brackets, that would be a nightmare. It can be difficult for you to take over that practice because ortho sometimes takes 2 years to finish. And so if the dentist just started 30 cases right before they sell the practice, well, then you are now going to have a bunch of patients that you have to continue that ortho work that was being done by the seller. Hopefully you looked at the documents and you realized, oh, there's a lot of ortho here. And you came to some sort of agreement where either the seller was going to stay on and finish those ortho cases, or the seller was going to give you a portion of the funds that were paid by the patient in order to continue that treatment. I mean, there's multiple different ways you can handle it. But the easiest way is just buy a practice where they're not doing much ortho. And then if you come in and add that ortho, great. But be very careful about buying a practice where there was a lot of ortho done in the previous year, especially in the previous 6 months before you buy the practice, because those cases probably aren't going to be finished. Next thing to look at are the expenses and overhead for the practice. Expenses can be a little bit confusing when you first look at them, because when you look at a profit and loss statement, the goal of a profit and loss statement is make these expenses look as high as possible so that you can pay as little as possible in taxes. So, of course, the dentist is going to be adding in as many different expenses as they can into that profit and loss statement in order to reduce their taxable income. They might be running a car through there. They might be running their personal health insurance through there. They might be running some vacations and trips through there. They might be running meals through there. They might be buying a new computer that they're using at their house. Cell phones, all sorts of stuff can be run through the business legally. And a lot of dentists take advantage of that, which I recommend you do. I recommend you take advantage of all the tax loopholes and things you can find. However, when you're buying a practice, it can make things a little bit more difficult because when you initially look at the expenses, they might be inflated relative to what the actual expenses are for the business. As a result, in order to streamline this process and simplify things for my clients, I generally simplify out those expenses into 4 main categories. Number 1 is the rent or mortgage payment if you end up buying the building. I like to keep that under 5% of your projected revenue. The loan repayment, I like to keep that under 12% for larger practices, 10% for medium practices, and 8% for smaller practices. Payroll, Ideally, we're keeping that under 30%, but lower is better. I've seen some dentists get that number as low as 20%. It's going to depend a lot on the type of practice you're running, the area you're in, but you know, you don't want it over 30%. And then all your other variable expenses, I generally group into a single category that I just call variable expenses. That's your supplies, your lab bills, your legal expenses, your office supplies, that type of stuff, usually about 20%. So let's say you add all those up, you have 30 plus 20 plus 12 plus 5. That's going to put you at a 67% overhead, which is okay. It's not great. I think you can generally do better, but that's an initial kind of range I aim for, is that 67% overhead. A lot of dentists end up doing better than that, but worst case scenario, you don't want to be much above that. So that is why you got to be careful. If you are buying a practice, you need to look at the rent. Is the rent actually going to be under 5%? If not, then maybe that's not the right practice to buy. Look at the staff overhead. If it's like really high, it might not be worth buying that practice. You want to make sure that that loan repayment is going to be affordable. Now, supplies, lab bills, all those other variable expenses, that's going to change when you take over the office, because you as a buyer are going to be running a different business than the seller run. You can choose a different lab. You can choose different supply companies. So those variable expenses, don't worry too much about what the seller was doing. But you do need to be looking at payroll and rent. Those are the big ones. And then your practice loan repayment, we need to calculate. The next thing to look at is the actual physical practice, the building you're going to be working in. It is possible, but it's difficult to change the location of a dental practice, especially in the first few years after you take over the office. You're not going to want to change the location. The reason is, when you buy the practice, patients are going to keep coming to the office because they know where it is, they're familiar with the location, and especially when you're a new dentist, you don't want to disrupt those habits and move the office right away. Occasionally, you can do a chart purchase where you purchase the charts from a practice and you just call all the patients and say, hey, I'm your new dentist, come see us over at this address. That can be okay. It's you're going to lose a lot of patients that way. There's going to be a lot of patient attrition. If you can get a really good deal on the charts, sometimes that ends up being a good investment. But for the most part, if you're buying a practice, plan on staying at the location for at least 2 to 3 years. So if you know you're going to be staying there, then you better do some due diligence to make sure that building is in good condition and it's going to meet the needs for your future business. The obvious thing, how many operatories are there? Are there enough operatories? Generally, you need 6 operatories in order to run a profitable solo practice, and 8 to 10 in order to run a multi-doctor office. The reason you need 6 operatories is you need 2 to 3 for hygiene and then 2 to 3 for treatment. And if you wanna have a second dentist working there, that dentist is gonna need at least 2 operatories. And if you bring in that second dentist, you might also have to bring in an additional hygienist. So now you might need 4 operatories for hygiene, and then you need at least 2 or 3 per doctor, so 8 to 10 total ops if you want to have 2 dentists working in the office. Oftentimes, you will find practices that only have 4 operatories. 4 is going to be cutting it close. If you're in a really big city, if you're in New York City or Chicago downtown, you might have to settle for a smaller office just because real estate is so expensive. But most areas, you want to try to find a little bit of a bigger office. I mean, with 4 operatories, let's say you have 2 hygienists, that only leaves 2 for you as the doctor. What happens if there's an assistant doing some temps or doing a scan and you have another patient that needs to be seated, but the room is being cleaned by another assistant? It's just, you're wasting your time. You have to go sit in your office waiting for your assistant to clean the room. It's just not a very efficient use of your time. It's better to have more operatories so that you can have more assistants and you can see more patients. Now, sometimes you'll find an office that it looks like it only has 4 operatories and it only has 4 chairs. But when you go to actually visit the office, you realize there's room for expansion. The building's big enough. They've got some rooms that maybe they're even plumbed and all you would have to do is buy another chair to put in there. If that's the case, then that's easy. But some offices are going to be much more difficult and some are just going to be absolutely impossible to add more operatories. So when you go to visit the office, that's one of the things you want to investigate. Are there enough operatories? And if there are not, how difficult would it be to add a few additional operatories if needed? Also, while you're in the office, you just want to look at the condition. Are you going to have to replace the flooring? I've seen some offices where there's carpet in the operatories. That is just disgusting. carpet, like all the germs and stuff flying and landing in the carpet. Yeah, like that's something you're going to need to replace right away. I saw one office where there was carpet in the bathroom. What if a toilet overflows and it's on the carpet? My goodness. Yeah, you are going to have to do some fix-ups in some offices that you look at. And so when you go to visit the office, just because it's in not the best condition, the building, doesn't mean you shouldn't buy the office. It just means you need to calculate in. It's going to cost me $50,000 to update this office. Is it worth it? Is it still worth it, even though I'm going to have to pay $50,000? And if you run the numbers and the answer is yes, then it still might be a great office to purchase, but you need to investigate before just blindly making an offer on a practice. Don't just assume everything's in good condition. You need to have the office properly evaluated to make sure that the chairs are going to be functional, that the suction and all of the lab equipment is going to keep working. Is the sterilization equipment in good order? Do you have up-to-date x-ray equipment? Are they still on film x-rays? Are they doing the phosphor plates that are going to have to be replaced? Or do they have brand new CBCTs and brand new sensors and you're going to come in and you're ready to get to work? Every office is going to be different. You can ask the broker some of these questions, but some brokers, they're not even dentists. Some brokers are dentists, some are not. They might not even know what you're talking about when you ask them some of these questions. You're going to have to go in there yourself, and you're probably going to have to hire someone to also go in with you to evaluate the office. It's absolutely worth it. You're about to make an enormous, very expensive purchase, maybe $1 million or more. Make sure that you are evaluating what you're purchasing. Now, if you're buying the building, you also are going to want to pay a building commercial real estate inspector to come in and see, like, is the foundation good? Is the roof going to need replaced anytime soon? What about the air conditioner? Is that in good condition? What about the pipes? Is there any asbestos or any other things you need to be worried about? Those are the types of questions you need to be asking, and you absolutely need to do that due diligence before you buy the practice. The next thing to look at is the market dynamics of the area that you're in. When you do a startup, you might need 300 to 400 new patients per year, because if you're trying to get to that 2,000 active patient number and you have zero patients, it's going to take you a long time to get to 2,000 if you only are seeing 70 patients per year. You'll never get there because some patients are going to leave. But on the other hand, if you're doing an acquisition, you're buying an existing practice, it already has enough patients. All you need is enough patients in order to replace patients that leave. So if you only have 50 or 60 patients leaving per year, you only need 50 or 60 new patients in order to maintain the size of the practice. This is why if you buy the right practice, you buy an existing practice that's already profitable and has enough active patients, you don't have to work that hard in order to get new patients in the door. Usually, if you have enough patients, they're going to be recommending their friends and family to come in. And just from friends and family of your existing patients, you're probably going to get enough patients in order to maintain the size and maintain your revenue, maintain your profits. Now, if you want to grow, maybe you need to do some additional marketing in order to try to get new patients in. But if you buy the right practice, demographics are so much less important. Stop worrying about demographics when you're doing an acquisition. It's not that important. Find a place that you like to live. Find a place that you're excited about. Find a place you're going to live there for the next 30 or 40 years, most likely, if you buy this practice. Make sure you love it there. This is your home. This is your community. Don't move somewhere you don't want to live just because some demographics report said it was slightly less competitive. If you buy a practice, you can live literally anywhere you want and still be very successful. Would I do a startup anywhere? No, I would not do a startup anywhere. But if you buy the right practice, you can buy it anywhere. And then finally, I've saved this one for last because it is the most important number. It's more important than anything. I know I said active patient number is important. I know I said revenue per patient is important. But the thing that ultimately matters at a dental practice, what's your net income going to be? How much money are you going to be making if you take over this business? What's the point of even buying a business if you're not going to be profitable, if you're not going to be making money? You might as well just stay at your associate job rather than buy some office that's not going to be profitable. How much money are you going to be making if you buy this office? Now, this is where I see so many dentists, like a lot of dentists make this mistake. They take the documents from the broker, they send them to an accountant, and they say, Mr. Accountant, how much money am I going to make at this office? And Mr. Accountant, maybe he has a few clients who are dentists. Sure, he knows how to read a financial statement. Sure, he's going to look at the profit from the seller in the previous year. And he's going to say, okay, well, the seller made $300,000 last year. Let's times that by 10%. And then that's how much you're going to make next year. And then we'll times that by 10%. And that's how much you're going to make the following year. And let's times that by 10%. And that's how much you're going to make in year three. And they give you this big document. Oh, by year 10, you're going to be making this much. And we used our advanced formulas to calculate that. Yeah, we took a Google sheet and times it by 10% every year. Accountants are great. You need an accountant to do your taxes. You absolutely, as a dentist, have to hire an accountant, and hire a good one. Hire a dental-specific CPA, because they are going to be able to save you so much money on your taxes if you hire the right accountant. However, most accountants are not that helpful when it comes to evaluating whether a practice is worth buying. They're simply going to look at how profitable the seller was. And remember, we already talked about, you can find practices where the seller was producing $2,000 per active patient. And from an accountant's point of view, that practice looks so profitable. Look, Dr. Jones was doing $1.5 million last year and walked away with $700,000 in profit. This is an incredible practice to buy. But if you actually dig into the numbers, Dr. Jones was producing $3,000 per active patient because he was over-treatment planning crowns, he was over-treatment planning implants, he was doing veneers on people who didn't even need veneers and selling all sorts of crazy treatment. And he had some advanced certifications from the Las Vegas Institute and all sorts of stuff that you as a general dentist are probably not going to either be able to do or want to do. And you come in and production drops from 1.5 down to 600,000. I mean, that I hope it wouldn't drop that much. That would be crazy. But I mean, it happens. And I have seen some dentists who, sadly, they did not reach out to me before they bought their practice. They came after. And he said, hey, doc, I bought this practice a year ago and my accountant said it was going to be great and I'd be super profitable, but I haven't been making much money and I need help. And I said, okay, send me over some documents. Let me take a look. And I look and they've got like 400 patients. They paid $1 million for a practice of 400 patients. I don't know what to, I can't help you at that point. You've already screwed it up. You already made the worst possible decision you could have made, your first decision buying a practice. And from this point on, you can do everything right. You could do every single thing right from that point forward. But that initial first decision that you made was the wrong one. And you've messed up long term. It's going to be almost impossible to steer that ship because you made such a bad mistake starting out. Yeah, you could do it. You're going to have to treat it like a startup. You're probably going to have to go get an associate job 2 or 3 days a week, and you're going to have to grow this practice as if it's a startup. And not only is it a startup, but it's a startup where you owe a lot of money to a bank for a practice loan. You know, that's not fun, but I mean, you dug this grave. You're the one who bought the wrong practice. Which is why, if you have not yet bought a practice, make sure you're buying the right practice or else it's not worth it. When you buy a practice, you need to calculate how much money are you going to be making at this office once you take into account the practice loan, once you take into account the rent, once you take into account your production per patient multiplied by the number of patients. This is the type of detail you need to be doing. This is the type of due diligence that you need to follow if you are going to be buying a $1 million practice. You need to make sure that you are taking this extremely seriously. Because if you buy the right practice, it's going to be the best decision you've ever made. If you buy the wrong practice, it might be the worst decision you've ever made, and it might cause an enormous amount of headaches if you're not going to take the time to properly make sure that you actually are going to make money at this practice, then just stay at your associate job, make $200,000 a year and be happy. But if you want to be a successful dentist who owns your own practice, take this seriously and make sure you are buying the right practice.